Thanks. Hi, I'm Jackie. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 19th of 2008. I have a sponsor and a home group. I have service at meetings. I do service at meetings. I do service on a broader level. I sponsor women. I work with women. I do those things, and I don't say them as like woohoo me, but just they're the foundation of my sobriety, I don't know who is new. Who's new? Is there anyone under in their first like 90 days here? Okay. Y'all are seasoned. I was, like, I feel like when I speak at like rehabs and stuff, I do the spiel of what a sponsor is and what a home group is, but y'all know that. So anyway, I'll tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now. As was read, just with this hope of like, maybe I have this thing or maybe this thing can work for me too. And, if you don't relate to me, like, please keep coming back. I am not anyone special in Alcoholics Anonymous. My story is not, sort of indicative of what alcoholism looks like, as far as the specifics. I do love though, the doctor's opinion where it talks about like all these different types of alcoholics. They talk about the manic depressive and they talk about like one who's always going on the wagon for keeps, and they list like all these different types, and they say like, all these have like one thing in common: they cannot start drinking without losing control over the amount they take. That's my experience. Is like, if I am looking at people's outsides, I can find something to pick apart. Like, yeah, I got arrested, but I never did like hard time. Yeah, I had a couple interventions and I was institutionalized, but it wasn't formally a rehab, relating out. But I relate to the way people drink and I relate to the way that people feel without alcohol, So anyway, I guess I'll just share generally, what my experience. I had my first drink. I was around 13. I was 13. I had just gotten out of the psych ward for the second time, right? I hear people in meetings talk about like feeling like they didn't get the handbook to life. I love how our AA literature talks about the sense of anxious apartness, And I would say that anxious apartness was pervasive in my life, like in my family, on sports teams I was on, in friend groups, like no matter where I was, I just felt somehow like I don't fit in here. I don't belong, And there were a lot of also bad circumstances going on in my life, and they don't make me alcoholic, but it was just, to sort of color the experience. My parents split when I was less than a year old. I was only a few weeks old. They were divorced by the time I was one, my dad came out after the divorce, and he would come visit us with his special friend, Mr. Greg, until he died of AIDS in like the mid 90s, so we had my mom, who, was violent and, just abusive in a lot of different ways. And my sister had this like really obscure illness where she just like limbs would dislocate. She had really low muscle tone. She had really low bone density. And so she would like fall and like break her femur, or she'd stand up and dislocate her knee, and there's always screaming and chaos and, just like a lot of like blah. And I feel like I was the healthy kid, so a lot of the time I was like the recipient of my mom's frustration and stuff, because my sister would like fall apart. So there was a lot going on, right? And I have journals from 6 years old talking about how depressed I am, and so by the time I got to drink, like I had a life that needed alcohol poured on it, right? And there are other people that I grew up with who had also crappy childhoods, and the thing is they take a drink and they don't have a reaction. They take a drink and it's a drink, like they smoke weed every now and then, they'll have a gummy, so like none of that stuff makes me alcoholic. That stuff made me wound pretty tightly, but what happened for me when I took a drink is like that all went away. I was in my mom's basement. She had these four bottles of liquor lined up on the top shelf. I still remember it. I remember the order they were in and, what everything looked like. I remember I was curious about what it felt like to be drunk. And so I grabbed a bottle of Seagram's extra dry gin. Because the other stuff was like creme de menthe, Kahlua, and a raspberry liqueur. And I intuitively knew not to mess with the fruity crap, So I got the gin and I took a swig and it was disgusting. I hate the taste of gin. It burned and I just remember feeling flushed and like choking on it, you know? And I didn't put the bottle down. And as soon as I got, you know, my breath back, I tipped the bottle up and I kept drinking. And my first drink was gin from the bottle by myself in my mom's basement. And I had so much fun, you know, like I just had a great time. I got drunk, you know, I fell down the stairs and I got sick at one point. And I just remember like having a good time, you know, like I didn't get in trouble. I didn't have any consequences other than the falling down the stairs thing. But you know, I wasn't seriously hurt. It was fine. And you know, I just enjoyed like my own company for the first time, maybe just ever. I was no longer like that depressed kid who had just gotten out of the psych ward and like all this awful stuff was happening. Like, no, I was just having a good time, you know? And I loved it. And I did not get a lot of opportunities to drink over the next couple of years. You know, the fact that I had gone to this like ward a couple of times was known in my high school and social circles. And so people were afraid of me. I was a weird kid, and so I didn't get invited out a lot. But every opportunity that I had to drink, I drank as much as I could, you know, but I was largely protected by lack of access to it. I was protected from myself. But as soon as I went away to school, to college, I was so excited because I knew that, first of all, I'm in a new place. I can reinvent myself. No one needs to know about all that dark and spooky stuff, you know. But second of all, you know, people drink in college and I'm gonna get to party. And the first night I was there, I found people who wanted to do what I wanted to do. And we went out and we found a keg party, you know, and I got drunk and I had a great time. I had a lot of fun. And it's weird though, because like I'm alcoholic. And so things that like seemed fun, you know, now sober me is like, you know, I don't know necessarily that like running from the cops or like being followed out of the club and like having to like run to try to get away from these guys and like diving into the metro car to try to get away from these people who are following us. Like getting home is like, woohoo, what a fun adventure, you know? But like later on, it's like, actually, that was scary, you know? That wasn't, but, it felt like fun at the time. So, but I drank and I had so much fun. I just had a great time. And, you know, I initially, if I had a good reason to not drink, I could keep it together. I could stay in, you know, I was on, my college's rowing team my freshman year of college. And so if we had a regatta on a Saturday morning, I wouldn't go out drinking on Friday night. I'd stay, you know, with the team, we'd stay together, we'd go to the race in the morning, and then Saturday night we'd like party. And you know, if I had an exam on a Friday, I wouldn't drink on Thursday. You know, I would show up and do the thing that I had to do. But I did start blacking out in like by, you know, by like halfway through my freshman year, I had my first blackout. And I know some people don't like them, but I loved blackouts. I absolutely loved it because, you know, like, I mean, I drink for the effect. Like I don't drink because it tastes good. I don't drink because like it pairs well with what I'm eating, you know. Like I drink because it shuts my brain up and it drops my shoulders, you know, and it like lets me be in the room with you. And you know, just that swirl of voices that like does not stop. Stops, you know, and for me, blacking out was like the ultimate of that. Like, I just didn't have to exist, you know. And also, sometimes I would come out of blackouts and people would try to have conversations with me about what I had done in the blackout. And I could just say, I don't remember it. So it didn't happen. And then avoid them, you know. And, it didn't really do great for those relationships, but like it kept me from feeling. I mean, I say like I wouldn't have to deal with that at the moment, you know? I mean, there's like the shame and guilt of like, okay, my friend and roommate says that like I like attacked her, you know, and got in a fight with her. So obviously, like I'm feeling shame and guilt about that, but like we don't have to, I don't have to actually confront it. I can just say I don't remember it. It didn't happen, you know? Or like sometimes, It was very good that I didn't have to remember what happened, because there would be flashes that would be like bad enough, that I didn't want to know the rest. So I loved blackouts, and people were already concerned about my drinking. And that was the first attempt I made to stop. I swore off for the spring semester, and this was in like February, and I made it about 6 weeks, and I made it until it was not the day after St. Patrick's Day. Yeah, it was the day after St. Patrick's Day. I made it to the day after St. Patrick's Day and figured, you know what? Good enough. 6 weeks is good enough, And from that point, I don't think I really tried to stop again. But anyway, but at some point though, I crossed the line that our literature talks about, crossing a line where, we can't control it anymore. And so I don't know exactly when that happened for me, but like in retrospect, I can pinpoint to like within a year, right? So I remember it was that St. Patrick's Day of freshman year, and I had an exam the day after. And so I didn't drink on St. Patrick's Day because I had this exam to show up for in the morning. And I was trying not to drink anyway. And so I went and like took this exam. And that night went out with my classmates and like celebrated and like got drunk and talked about the exam and whatever. And so I had something to show up for. So I stayed in, I didn't drink, and then I drank. And then but fast forward a year later, and it's like fresh or so, second semester of my sophomore year, and I had an exam on a Friday morning, and I remember thinking, I'm not gonna drink tonight because I have this exam at 10 o'clock in the morning. It's really important, I have to show up for. So I'm gonna stay in, I'm gonna study, but it's Thirsty Thursdays. So like my friends are hanging out. I'm just gonna hang out, but I'm not gonna drink. I'll go to the hookah bar with them, I'll smoke some hookah, but I'm not gonna drink. And then after the hookah bar, people went back to this guy Justin's place. And I could have gone home, but I don't know. My brain's like, no, we'll just go with them, And then after I'll go home, go to sleep, wake up, cram in the morning, And then we get to Justin's house and he busts out a bottle of vodka. And my brain switches to, you've been really stressed out about this exam tomorrow. You should have a drink just to take the edge off. And I did. And then the next thing I knew, it was 7 o'clock in the morning. And I was so drunk that I couldn't walk back under my own power. And Justin and this guy Pinto were like dragging me back to my dorm. And I showed up to my 10 a.m. exam. I did make it, hair and makeup just like smeary mess from the night before, oozing vodka. And so drunk, it took me three tries to write my name on the paper, And so, like, same reason to not drink. And at one point I could, and then at some point I crossed the line where like I changed my mind with all of the intention to not drink, and this thing that's important to me, my mind just changed and it made sense for me to drink, And then also at that time, I was starting to, make choices about this stuff that I would do sober in order to be able to drink, and I remember making decisions, like being with like shady people, just really grimy people. And, I was underage at the time. And my experience as an underage woman is I used what I had in order to get what I wanted, And so I had to make decisions about like what I was willing to do in order to be able to drink the way that I wanted to drink. And I remember being like physically sober and having the thought that like whatever price I have to pay, it doesn't matter, because by the time I have to pay up, I'll be so drunk I won't remember it, And like being as physically sober, making that decision as I am tonight, and it not flagging at all that that was a problem. I really thought, this is fun and I can stop whenever I want, and I'm living life because I'm having a good time and partying and whatever. And so my alcoholism progressed. I lost a bunch of stuff, the first thing to go were my scholarships because I tanked my grades. First thing to go was a lot of relationships, honestly. I drank myself off of a soccer team. I left the crew team voluntarily. I drank myself out of like a surfing club, just because of shenanigans. And then yeah, like my scholarships and there were some too, like decisions that I made, right? That like everything, like the thing that is so scary about like my alcoholism is like it still looks like I'm driving. Like I'm not driving the ship, but like it looks like I am, right? Like it speaks in my own voice. And like my major was like physics, and I was working, the school I was at was number one in the country at the time for a specific field of physics. And I got into a lab in that field, you know, which was just like this incredible opportunity. But you can't drink on the job in a nonlinear dynamics lab, in my experience. I couldn't figure out how to do it, you know, but in my mind, you know, I told myself like I'm just too stressed, like juggling this job and school, it's just too much. So I need an easier job where I don't have to think about it. So I left that lab to work at a convenience store. But the truth is that like I could bring my backpack and keep it under the counter, under the register at the convenience store, and me and my coworker would like drink on the job together, you know? And so things like that, like dreams and aspirations were like, we're just gonna do this other thing over here. And so what happened for me is, you know, I mean, my drinking progressed, it was becoming more and more. There's like one big thing in particular that I had this ambition to do and had been working towards, and like lost that because of like my drinking and other stuff that I was doing. And once that last thing to hold on to was gone, I just kind of like didn't care anymore, you know, and gave myself permission to just do whatever, you know. But my tolerance was getting so high, and it would take so much to black me out. Or like quiet my brain, that I started supplementing with other stuff, like not drugs, but like household stuff that you're not supposed to ingest, you know, because I found out that like if I drink this other stuff, then two beers will black me out. And so it also made me hallucinate on its own, you know, and so sometimes I would just drink it and hallucinate for hours. And I didn't realize that I was like slowly, systematically poisoning myself, you know. And so what happened is I had a seizure, and then within a few days of having that seizure, it was actually Super Bowl Sunday of 2007. And I remember that because like I had that seizure on a Wednesday, and then that Sunday I like collapsed in my apartment and I felt like I was dying. I couldn't move. I couldn't really speak. And I just, you know, my roommate was there and she called 911. And later, when I made amends to her, she told me, because everyone knew something was really wrong with me, but they didn't know what it was. They didn't know what I was doing. And my roommates were so concerned about me. They were afraid that if they left me alone, they would come back and find me dead. And so they assigned 12-hour shifts to over the course of the weekend, so that someone was constantly monitoring me. And so she was supposed to be at a Super Bowl party and she didn't go because it was her turn to make sure I didn't die. And she may have saved my life, you know. I don't know what would have happened if she wasn't there. But yeah, so but that was like sort of the gig was up, right? Like the house of cards is just down. And everyone knew what was going on. And so I got out of the hospital and went home for a couple of days, and then came back to my apartment and had two interventions on the same day, which is my experience is like God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Because my mom and therapist had an intervention for me in the morning, and I said, screw you guys, you know, I'm fine. And my roommates had like a professional mediator person, and they staged an interview. They were not coordinated at all, but like, it was bad. So they had an intervention for me that evening, and that one broke me. I was like, okay, fine, and agreed to go inpatient someplace. But I had this other thing going on. I had developed an eating disorder in my freshman year of college. And I only mentioned that because that was like the flag of like, I'm such a manipulator, right? And I was like, that's why I'm drinking and ingesting these other substances, because my eating disorder, I'm like using this to manage my eating disorder. So if we treat my eating disorder, then I won't drink anymore. Because I didn't want to go to rehab. I didn't want to like look at my drinking, you know. So like anything, any smoke and mirrors I can wave to like not have to stop drinking. So they put me in a dual place. They put me in an eating disorder place with like a substance abuse program. But it took like a 3 or 4 weeks between that and like getting actually admitted somewhere. So I did have a couple like near miss experiences in that period too, right? I had an overdose and ended up in the hospital, and then I totaled my car in a blackout, you know? And so, I mean, that place did save my life, like being physically removed from it and being institutionalized. They detoxed me. And I just remember at that point, I felt so tired, you know? Like I was so tired of like everything that I had to do in order to stay as messed up as I needed to stay. And like the lies and the juggling and the financial juggling, you know? And like they're the what am I going to take from to pay rent? And then what am I going to take from to like make that up? And there were times where I was like dumpster diving for meals because I spent all my money, you know, like drinking or trying to. It was so exhausting. And I just remember being very relieved to have a break, you know? And while I was in there and while I was detoxed, I could see that my life was garbage and that everything about the dumpster fire of my life was directly related to my drinking, you know? And I like swore off drinking. I have this journal, I still have it, that is just full of, you know, just these promises. I don't know. It's really funny. The Bill Wilson, if you go into the central office, the WAIA, Washington Area Intergroup, they have like copies of like, you know, I think it's like the inside of like his Bible to Lois, where it's like all the written promises he's made to her about how he's gonna stop drinking. Like that's my journal, was just like all these promises about like I'm gonna stop drinking and what I'm gonna do and how I'm gonna turn it around. And the day they moved me to outpatient, I was drunk. Like the day they moved me. And you know, they did not bring in, I wasn't ready, but they also didn't bring in meetings, right? So I had no defense, like being set out into the world. It was just me. And it's not that I changed my mind. I did not remember that I didn't want to drink. I totally forgot everything I had written when I was in there and every ounce of like clarity that like I didn't want to do this anymore and how awful things were was just gone. And so like when our literature talks about like strange mental blank spots, like that's my experience is like sometimes my mind changes and sometimes like I don't even see it coming, you know? And so I hear people in meetings sometimes talk about like think the drink through if you're thinking about drinking and like maybe that works for some people, but like I don't have that luxury. Like I have many experiences of just like being just trained coming out of nowhere, you know, and being drunk and having just no warning that it's coming, you know. Like I have no defense. And so like I need the defense that comes from the steps. Like I had a sponsor at one point who, you know, she used this metaphor of like an umbrella. Like I take these actions and they keep me under the umbrella of God's grace. And if I am like not under that umbrella, like I'm gonna get wet, you know, like it's, I don't have a choice. And but so yeah, like I was drunk, like I said, the day they moved me to outpatient, and the last 9 months of my drinking were really just round the clock, you know. I would maintenance drink. I was sleeping on an air mattress on my grandmother's floor at that point, you know. I had everything I own fit in 2.5 cardboard boxes in her corner of her bedroom. And the second half of that third box was full of empties. That's where I'd had my empties and then shovel them out in the middle of the night. But yeah, I would come to and drink through the day, you know, and drink through whatever I had to get through and then drink myself unconscious, drink myself to sleep at night, you know, and more consequences happened in there. There was like, you know, alcohol-induced gastritis a couple times. There was like a DUI, just all sorts of stuff was happening. And, you know, none of it slowed me down. Sometimes I would try to, you know, well, I won't drink with them anymore, or I'll never drink 151 again, you know. One time, it was probably the worst night of my drinking. Anyway, but they never really slowed me down, right? And so every night when I would be drinking myself unconscious, I would just be like coming up with all these plans of like, I'm gonna go back to school, or I'm gonna get my own place, or I'm gonna move to Chicago. Like just plans of how I was going to change something externally, and then I wouldn't feel so crappy anymore, and then I wouldn't have to drink like this anymore. But until then, as long as my life sucks like this is just what I'm gonna have to do, you know? But I would like go to sleep every night, like pass out every night, just with these plans and delusions, you know? And so what happened for me is that I had this like moment of clarity, right? Where like I could not get drunk enough to delude myself into thinking that it was gonna be better, you know? Like I was physically drunk, and you know, I just knew that I was full of crap. And if I could have enacted any of these plans, if I could have done anything about the way my life was, I would have done it long before then, because I had been so miserable for such a long time. And I knew that I was never going to be able to actually do any of this stuff. And it was just going to be like this until I died. And I felt like an animal in a claw bear trap, that my leg was caught and I was just going to bleed out until I died. And I had been to AA meetings at this point, from the DUI and other, anytime I would, there were a couple of brushes with the police, and then I'd go to AA, and then I'm not alcoholic, and then I'd leave and celebrate my non-alcoholism by drinking. I will say that like it planted the seed though, where like I started questioning. You know, I went to my first meeting, and then, you know, they talk about being powerless over alcohol, and I was like, I'm not powerless. And so, you know, at that point, I drove with a case of beer on the floor of my car, because then you can drink on your way to where you're going. No one at your source or destination sees how much you're drinking, and you can still. So I, you know, drank while I drove. And, you know, if I ran out of my car beer and I could make it home without stopping at the liquor store, that meant I still had control, because if I'm powerless, that means I have to stop. And so I'd like white knuckle it all the way home, and then I'd get to my grandmother's house where I was sleeping on her floor, and I would celebrate my non-alcoholism by drinking her cooking sherry. So, you know, so I'd been to AA and decided I was an alcoholic, and so I tried to kill myself, you know, and what happened is I just could not successfully kill myself. And there's one more, you know, just like I feel like last ditch attempt. I drove out to the Chesapeake Bay Bridge, and I was going to jump, and I could not stop my car. You know, everything in me wanted to just stop, and I could not do it. And I drove back and forth over the bridge twice, and it was on my second pass back where I'm just like hysterical and just like scream crying, because I just want to stop and I can't, you know. And I said, God, there has to be more than this. It was the closest thing to a prayer I'd said in a really long time. I was really rageful about any sort of idea of God, and I had like you know, long since sworn off religion, but like I said, the closest thing to a prayer I'd said in a really long time. 'Cause like, if you cannot live the way that you're living, and you cannot do anything about the way that you're living, and you can't die, like what are you supposed to do? You know, like I was totally out of options. And you know, for me, that was like my moment of surrender, you know, like, and it felt like something inside me snapped, and I just started like sobbing. And I drove home, and whew, a week later, I was back in another AA meeting. Like I had slips that I had to get signed from a substance abuse program I was enrolled in because of the DUI that I had gotten while I was like pending court. And like it's so funny, because for a really long time I struggled with the idea of a higher power in AA, and I was really resentful about it and really thought about it. But like in my own story, like I was on the Bay Bridge trying to die, and I said a prayer, and I have not had a drink from that day to this. And a week later, like I was in an AA meeting. Like God picked me up from that bridge and put me down in AA, you know? And like, so it just kind of like blows my mind that like, but it's my life, you know, and I'm personally attached to it. So like, of course I have my own like resentments and crap with God, you know? But like now in retrospect, I'm like, wow, I don't know how I could have doubted. But anyway, so yeah, that's what happened, is I ended up in AA detoxing. Like I didn't know. Oh, I was so fried. I didn't even know I was detoxing, right? Like I was hallucinating people who weren't there. I hit and run a taxi cab on the drive there, because I was like, I was shaking so bad. I didn't know that when you're new, you're not supposed to have a full cup of coffee, so I've poured myself a full cup of coffee and I shook it out all over the floor. And these women circled me. They were so sweet. They just got paper towels and cleaned up the coffee and invited me to come up front and sit with them and put me right in the front row. And they asked for my phone number, and I actually gave them the correct phone number this time. Because when I'd been to AA before, I'd never gave people my actual phone number. I usually gave them my sister's because it was only one digit off from mine, and so it was easy to remember. And but I actually gave people my phone number, and I had that slip to get signed. And so after the meeting, I went up to the secretary to get my slip, and she gave me her number. She got mine, and she invited me to, they were having a sober party that night, and she invited me to come along. And I had not had a sober interaction with people for like 9 months up to that point. And like, it was like this. It was very brightly lit, and people were like very happy and talkative, and I was just staring at the ground, and like grunting monosyllabic responses like at people, and still hallucinating, and just shaking. And so the idea of like a sober party was like way too much, so I told her I was gonna go home and knit. And she said later on she thought I was full of crap and she was never going to see me again. But that's actually what happens. Like, I left that meeting and I drove home, and as terrified as I was to be around people not drunk, like, I remember feeling safe for the very first time in like a really long time. Like, something inside me felt safe, and I went home and I didn't drink and I knit and went to bed, and she called me the next day. I think three people called me, and I only picked up her call. But she made a plan with me for the following Monday. And she lived in Rockville. The meeting was in Rockville. And I lived like just south of Baltimore, which is like an hour away. And she still drove. Oh, I had a car. My grandmother had bought me a car after I had totaled one in the blackout. And so I still had a car only because of her. But she came and picked me up and drove me to the meeting anyway, and made a plan with me. She asked me about the next night, and I was like, that's too much time, in one-on-one with one person, like, I can't talk to you that much, but sure, I will meet you there, and I went to that meeting, and they suggested, she told me, you should not leave this meeting tonight without a sponsor, and like, at that point, I had been saying okay to people. I had said okay when, she asked me about the Monday meeting, and okay when she asked about the Tuesday meeting, and so I said okay. And it's so funny because it's such a God thing, and I hear people talk about like interviewing lots of people as, for sponsors, and that's not my experience. My experience is I was like 100% terrified of everyone in that room, and I was only 95% terrified of her, because when she had been driving me home from that meeting on Monday night, she took the last cigarette out of her cigarette pack and she crumpled it up and threw it out the window. She littered. And I remember thinking like, that's messed up, but she, like, I felt like people shared their stories, and like they talked about doing the same scummy things that I had done. And like, someone in the Monday night meeting talked about being a bedwetting drunk, and I was a bedwetting drunk, sometimes with other people in the bed, and that's just embarrassing, And so people said the same things, but like, they looked clean and shiny and happy, and I felt like I didn't deserve to breathe the same oxygen that you people were breathing, And she had done something wrong, and that made herself just a little human to me, So I was just a little less afraid of her. And so I asked her to be my sponsor, and it was the perfect fit for me, I had a lot of rage when I got sober. I did not get a pink cloud. I'm very happy for people who do, but I did not. I mean, you take alcohol away from me, and like, I, had a sponsor who describes it as like walking through a cheese grater, just like, I am like an exposed nerve, and I got rageful, I had road rage. I had never had road rage when I was drinking because I had my carb beer, like, everything was fine. But I was not a happy camper. And she was someone who had a lot of the same defects, right? And so that was really useful. But she got me right into the steps. Like, thank God. She told me right away, go to a meeting every day. And I was like, that's a lot, like, I'm working, I'm in school. And then living life sober, though, like, I needed to be in the meeting. Like, the only time I couldn't even shower because my head was so loud and there were no distractions. And like I would like run into the bathroom fully clothed and like wash my hair under the faucet and run out because I couldn't be alone with my head for that long, you know? And so I found though that like maybe like 15 or 20 minutes into the meeting, my head would finally shut up, you know? Not before the meeting, because then you guys are all talking to each other and like, how, what am I supposed to talk to you about, you know? And like the self-centered chatter or whatever. And but like I would calm down and I would feel better in the meeting. And so I was in meetings all the time, you know, any opportunity I could, I was like, I feeling crazy, you know, because I thought about drinking all the time too. And she got me doing service, you know, which helps me feel like the meeting was my meeting and helps me like make friends in AA, because God, I needed people, you know. And then she got me into the book because I was not convinced of alcohol, that I was alcoholic when I got here. Like I came here because I was out of options and I had that court slip. And you know, but I didn't know if I was alcoholic. I'd feel uncomfortable when they read the preamble about the only requirement for membership is his desire to stop drinking, because I didn't know if I met that criteria, you know. And she would tell me like, well, you're here, you clearly don't want to drink right now, so like you're fine, you know, stay. And we started with the doctor's opinion and went through, you know, we went through the book, and when we got to a step, we worked it. And I found myself in, you know, the doctor's opinion, and then in like more about alcoholism, she would have me highlight stuff that I related to, and like 80% of that was purple, you know. And we're talking about like being a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and you know, seldom mildly intoxicated, usually more or less insanely drunk. Yeah, you know. And I have this like sick sense of pleasure when they talk about you know, women going down the scale faster than men and being beyond recall within a short time. Yeah, you know. And then, but I did my first fourth step by the time I had maybe like 6 weeks, you know. She got me, and I'm so glad, you know, because I think she knew like I didn't have a wide window. I had that window of willingness, and she was like, let's jump on it before it closes, because it's not going to stay open forever. And she was right. Like my ego kicked right back up by like 3 months, you know. And I got all like, well, where's mine, where's my money, where's my boyfriend, where's my, why isn't my family talking to me yet, like why, you know. Me. But like for that first 3 months, I was just like, whatever you guys tell me to do, I'll do it, you know. And so we did a fourth and fifth step, and I did the best that I could. I kept one thing off of it. And then within a couple of weeks, I was so crazy. And I love the fellowship. Like, I had a running buddy who got sober right around the same time I did. And we had gone to the diner with a bunch of people after the meeting. And he was like, what is wrong with you? There is something going on. I was driving him home after the diner. And I told him, like, I kept a secret from my sponsor. And I told him I was really uncomfortable. And so once he got out of the car, I was going to go drink or kill myself. And he was like, why don't you just call your sponsor? You know, and he did not get out of the car until I called her. And I got honest, and it was totally fine. It was not a big deal. She shared what she had done that was similar, and then I drove home and was okay, you know. And it was sometime after I did that fifth step that the desire to drink went away. Like I remember it was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I was at the beach with other sober people, and like I realized that I had not thought about the fact that I'm alcoholic, where all the liquor stores are. Do I want to be sober? Even if I want to be, is it worth it? Because this is awful, you know, and killing myself and like all this crap that I have to do. Like I hadn't thought about any of it. I had just been present at the beach, you know? And that was like the moment that hooked me on AA, right? Like I feel like when I came here, my sponsor was like, trust nothing, try everything. But to some degree, you're like relying on other people's experience, right? You're telling me you did this stuff and it got better for you. And so, okay, I'm just gonna do it because I don't have any other ideas. And like, all right. But then, like, it became my experience that that went away. And if I could have removed that on my own, I would have done it well before I tanked my life, you know? And that I was sold, you know, at that point. And so, you know, I feel like I spent the next couple of years like terrified that I was going to get struck drunk, you know? And yeah, anyway, so I, yeah, sort of. Don't know. I feel like in the talking about like what happened, right? Because it's been like almost 18 years, you know, God willing, it'll be 18 years in March, 18 years of like what happened, you know. But so with that sponsor, you know, like I said, we had done a fourth and fifth step, and you know, I feel like my experience with that too is that like there were certain things from that that like, because then you're supposed to move on to six and seven, right? They're next chronologically. And there were areas in my inventory that like I didn't, you know, I did not invite God in. I did not allow myself to be sponsored in those areas, you know, I, you know, just decide like I'm gonna do this. And, you know, I ended up having to do another fourth and fifth step because I'm like running around like seething with resentment and like absolutely crazy. And you know, my inventory of like sober looked almost identical in some areas to my inventory drunk, you know, and that was sort of a wake-up call for me of like, oh, if I don't actually start like inviting God and my sponsor like into this stuff, like it's not gonna change, you know. The this it's not a confession, right? Where I just come and tell everyone and do like a couple Hail Marys and then I'm good. Like I actually have to make concerted effort. And you know, my first sponsor drank after when I had a little over a year, and then I got her sponsor to be my sponsor. And she, you know, got me into my eighth and ninth step, you know. The eighth step was really, I had a difficult time with that. You know, I'm very like, I'm more on the depressive type, you know, I'm so awful and like I destroy this person's ability to trust people ever again. She's like, whoa, whoa, you know, like what did you actually do? You stole money. Like, okay, let's pay it back. And but so I had to write like on the top of my eighth step, like there's a line in the 12 and 12. I love the literature. But it talks about like an objective you will be our steadfast aim, you know? And I, you know, for myself, like if I'm using the steps are designed to get me out of myself, clear this stuff away so I can like be useful and especially to other alcoholics, but like to the world at large. And so if I'm using any of the steps to engender more self, I'm probably doing it wrong. So like my eighth step is not a tool to like beat myself up, right? It's a tool to examine how I can have the best possible relations with everyone around me, you know, which is an ongoing thing. It's not like a static list. Like, and that's something that I've only recently, like in the last couple of years, been like, oh, like the eighth step is still something that I'm working on, you know? But yeah, and then I've had so many different amends experiences. And some have been great and some have been not so great, you know? And the good news is like I have gotten to get better from all of them, right? Like when I made amends to my mom, she glared at me and told me that there was no way I could ever fix what I have done. I better never effing do it again, but there's no way I can repair what I've done. And then she just continued to glare at me in silence for the next couple of minutes and then changed the subject and started talking about work. And I was like, all right, that's not what I expected, right? Like I heard people, you know, have these like amazing stories of their families being reunited, you know, and having these like great relationships. And that was not my experience. And you know, but my experience is like my side of the street was clean. My experience was I learned how to stop punishing my mother. I didn't stop punishing her as soon as I made the amends, you know, like I can communicate just fine without opening my mouth what I think about you and what you're doing right now, you know. And so stopping doing that and you know, showing up as a daughter for my family, for her, and you know, learning what's mine and what's not, right? Like I remember at one point I had about I was just shy of 4 years at the time, and we were going to my aunt's funeral. I had an aunt who had married into the family and then divorced out, who never identified as one of us, but she probably was. She died of cirrhosis in her early 40s. She was not able to stay sober long enough to get on the liver transplant list, and she died before, you know, she could. Anyway, so we're driving to the funeral, and you know, my mom said something about I'm in the back seat with my sister, my grandmother's in the front seat with her, and she says something to my grandmother about how this liver transplant list about how she's glad Tracy didn't get one because alcoholics don't deserve second chances and the medical community should let them die and save the organs and time and effort for people who actually deserve to be alive. And I'm in the back seat, like almost 4 years sober. You know, I made my amends at like 18 months and I've been showing up, you know, and so I said something about, you know, sometimes alcoholics get sober and go on to live like these successful lives where they're productive, contributing members of society. And she was like, no, they should die. And I was like, all right, you know? And so I did the time-honored, sometimes shut your mouth is a spiritual principle. And so I kept my mouth shut and just waited for them to change the subject and then popped back in when it was safe, you know? And I was talking to my sponsor about it later, and she was like, okay, that's not your stuff, you know? And so that ability, my side of the street was clean. And so being able to separate out, you got some stuff going on over there, and that has nothing to do with me, you know? And anyway, so yeah, man, so I've made a lot of amends that were really great too, though. You know, I got to make amends to, you know, I at one point, God, I don't know how I got this job, but I was in an after-school care program. I was doing inclusion for children with disabilities, and I was assigned one specific girl, and I would drink cough medicine on the way, or drink beer in my car. And then I was not present for this girl. You know, she'd get pegged in the face with a dodgeball, and I would just laugh, you know, like I was awful. And it was not appropriate for me to make amends to her, but my direction was to have the conversation with her mother. And so I was convinced this woman was gonna just punch me in the face, you know, how could you not if someone did not take care of your child? I'm a mom now, you know, and I would have a very difficult time. And so I went and I had this conversation with her, and I could see the rage flash across her face, and then it settled. And then she sat down with me and we had a conversation about forgiveness, you know, and how we're all God's kids and she's messed up too, and God forgives everyone, and so I should stop beating myself up, you know. And so just stuff like that, where some of them have been great and some not so much, you know. And I don't know, you know, that stuff with my family. So I mean, lots of stuff has happened in sobriety. I got to go to grad school. I got to finish undergrad. Got to go to grad school, have this career, you know, I got married, boy meets girl on AA campus. And then, you know, but they say make sure you're compatible before you do that. And I did not do that part. So I ended up getting a pandemic divorce, which is really interesting and really challenging, because you know, nothing so much ensures immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. And so when stuff would be going on with my family or stuff would be going on with me, you can go to the halfway house and fill your car full of people and take them to the meeting, you know, or just any sort of get to the meeting early. And even if you don't have a service position, stand in the greeting line and say hi to people, you know, and meet people. What there's always stuff to do. But we were in a pandemic, you know, no meetings were happening where I was. And you know, things were on Zoom, but I couldn't go stay out to the diner until 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, and I had to a couple things, right? I had to tap into a power, the power greater than myself, that I have gotten access to because of the steps. Like I said, when I got here, I was rageful about the idea of God, right? But at some point in my sobriety, I hurt myself enough trying to manage my own stuff, you know, not having a third step, that I had to surrender to this idea of maybe I don't know what's happening, you know. And through working the steps, my experience is directly from a result of working the steps, I have developed a relationship with a power greater than myself, you know. And you know, I go to a book study, and they always insist whenever you're reading a chapter and it has asterisk, see Appendix 2, spiritual experience, they insist on reading it every time. And I'm really glad they do. I'm not big on appendices or intros as a rule, but that talks about our members finding they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, you know. And so having to go through this really painful experience without this bubble of AA, you know, that's what I leaned on, is this unsuspected inner resource, you know. And also though, trying to find ways to still be of service. How do I have a 12 step? What does that look like in the pandemic, you know? So me and friends were brainstorming, oh, can people get in little pods and we can do a video scavenger hunt, you know, how do we make fellowship for the new people who need to run around so they're not sitting at home twiddling their thumbs, bored out of their mind, and thinking about how much cooler their drinking life was? We got to give them something to do, you know, at a sponsor, she said, that's what the fellowship is for. It's to keep you around long enough for like the steps to work and you to get your God, you know? So like trying to brainstorm, like what do socially distanced like fellowship activities look like? What can we give people to do, you know? And like reaching out to, there was a halfway house that had, you know, like they had stopped having meetings and stopped letting the residents go out to meetings, but reaching out to them and saying, like, okay, if we are masked and we are outside, can we bring in meetings to your picnic tables, you know, and do them outside in your front yard? And they let us like bring in meetings on Friday nights and do it that way, you know. And so getting to do that. And there was this speaker too. I go to this women's retreat every year. I love it. And every year I feel like I take something away from it that is like just stays with me. But this woman was talking about, you know, she had gone through something really tragic, and she was talking about how like this would be a great opportunity to like act out. And she was sure like everyone would give her a pass, you know. But this idea that, you know, when things are at their worst, that's when I have to be at my best. Like coming back to like 6 and 7, right? Like, yeah, it would be understandable if I started shopping to like try to make myself feel better, if I started trying to like act out in other ways to make myself feel better. But like when I'm acting defectively, that cuts me off from you and that cuts me off from my God. And like all the time, I need the channel between me and you to be open. And that's what the steps do. And I need the channel between me and my God to be open. And that's what the steps do. And when I act out on stuff, you know, or when that selfishness and self-centeredness, like that blocks me off. And so like I need that channel to be open, but especially when stuff is going on, I need you and I need my God and I need that channel clear. And so like this idea of like when things are at their worst, that's when I need to be at my best. And like, you know, I mean, I got through that. And it's messed up though, because like when the difficult stuff passes, I feel like that's when it's easy to like foot off the gas. Like that idea of like I have to like be at my best, and like what does that look like? But you know, I'm still defective and it's still painful sometimes, you know. And so like now as I'm saying this, I'm like, man, I need to get back to that, you know, because like even when things are good, it's when I need to be at my best. But I think my point is like, you know, AA like has been sort of like the primary purpose, right? My primary purpose is to stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. And like no matter what good or bad has been going on in my life, like that has been sort of my lighthouse, you know. And especially during that period, that visual really helps me of like I am in like rough seas right now and I don't know where things are going to land, but if I keep my ship heading towards that lighthouse and just stay focused on that, then like everything's going to land where it's supposed to land and it'll all be okay. And maybe I need to change my definition of what okay looks like, but it will be okay. And I'll get to stay sober and I'll get to be useful, you know? And so, yeah, like helping others, you know, staying sober for me, like working the steps to the best of my ability and then helping other alcoholics to achieve sobriety, you know? Like I said, I just try to keep that as my lighthouse, you know, good or bad. So, anyway, it's five of, so I'll wrap it up. But thank you guys so much for asking me to come out. Thank you for letting me share.
Oh, thank you.